standing at the edge of vast open graves into which the riddled bodies fell in grotesque heaps? Did the Germans actually feed into their gas chambers over 960,000 innocent children, a number that is equivalent, if you want a visual cognate, to 10 Wembley stadiums filled to capacity with kids under 13? Do our eyes deceive us when we watch those films of the shuffling, living skeletons wandering around mountains of shriveled corpses in the camps of Belsen, Auschwitz, Birkenau, Treblinka, etc., etc.? Were these zombies once ordinary, normal human beings like you and me? To reflect on these things is to plunge oneself into a nightmare of unbearable ghastliness. The human mind is incapable of comprehending the magnitude and the mathematics of such slaughter. But alas, it isn't a nightmare. It's all too dreadfully true, and it is all recorded in minute detail in the vast literature on the subject that now exists. Just ponder this item, for instance. At the recent Auschwitz trial in Frankfurt, a dispute rose as to the exact number of victims who were massacred in that death camp. Finally, it came out in evidence that of 4,400,000 men, women, and children, approximately the entire population of Denmark, who were condemned to Auschwitz, only 60,000 were still alive when the camp was liberated, which means that 98.5% of all the deportees were methodically exterminated by the Germans. This arithmetic of butchery, this harvest of death, would stagger the imagination even if the carnage concerned rats, never mind human beings. Well, that was the burden of guilt which the Germans bore when the war ended, and for this culpability they have made no act of atonement as a nation. One often asked in the early days whether a people who had done these things, either by active participation or silent acquiescence, could ever live down such a legacy of inhumanity. Dare they ever lift up their heads again in civilized society? Would the brand of Cain stay forever on the German brow, just as the tattooed Star of David would remain indelible on the arms of many a victim who escaped? These were questions which only time could answer, and time indeed has answered them. For it is a fact that within a matter of 3 decades, that nation which perpetrated the greatest massacre of human souls in all history, virtually before the very eyes of the world, that nation has been able to resume its place in the comity of peoples with utter self-assurance and complete composure, actually being welcomed by the President of America as our devoted, staunch, and honorable ally. Today, people don't talk anymore about the mass murder of 6 million human beings. They don't even want to read about it any longer. Books on the subject are now categorized disparagingly as concentration camp stuff, and as such are virtually unsaleable. The world seems to have agreed to let the matter drop, and nobody has more sedulously promoted this "forget it" campaign than the Germans themselves, not for any particular reasons, but simply to restore our good name, as Adenauer once naively put it. They even tried recently to introduce a law to stop any more Nazi trials because these served only to perpetuate the legends of the gas chambers, the crematoria, and the torturings. By a sort of tacit consent, the very nomenclature of Germany's misdeeds has, over the years, been modified so that euphemisms such as the Holocaust, the final solution, genocide, etc., are now used to mask the inherent and stunning horror of what is plainly massacre, slaughter, and bestiality. And we are reminded always that it was the Nazis, a mythical horde of subhumans from outer space, who did it all. They descended, unbidden, on the most highly sophisticated, cultured nation on Earth, and issued orders which they dare not, could not, and did not disobey. Apparently, no living German was ever a Nazi. Very few even saw one, and whatever atrocities did happen took place during what is known as the Hitler era, or in the time of the Nazis, which is the greatest collective alibi ever conceived. Small wonder, then, that the world should so quickly forget crimes, which nobody ever saw, committed by external criminals whom nobody ever knew. To forget all may be easy, but to forgive all must be something more than a pulpit platitude. First, we must ask ourselves in whose hands lies the privilege of granting forgiveness. We can, of course, say, with the Ecclesiastics, that mercy and forgiveness belong entirely to God, in which case the whole dialogue comes abruptly to an end. Or we can subscribe to the dictum of the poet Dryden, "Forgiveness to the injured doth belong." But unfortunately, the injured in this case, 6 million martyred dead, are incapable of exercising such prerogative, or indeed of expressing any opinion at all. And if the dead can't forgive, neither can the living. How can you possibly forgive monsters who burned people alive in public, in ceremonies, staged in the open, with typical Teutonic pomp and precision? Could we even expect the Almighty to exonerate them? But it is precisely a hideous crime like this that is central to the challenging question posed in the Sunflower. Was Wiesenthal right in refusing to forgive the dying Nazi? You can ignore the question, or evade it, or hedge it about with casuistic hair-splitting, but the simple issue remains. What would you have done in Wiesenthal's shoes? There is no generic answer. It is an individual dilemma that demands a personal answer. I, for one, would have had no hesitation in solving the problem. I figure it this way. Wiesenthal himself was about to die, ignominiously and forgotten, as a direct result of all those ideals and those standards which the dying Nazi and millions like him were proud to defend and fight for. I would have asked myself, what might the young Nazi have become had he survived, or indeed, if Germany had won the war? I would have tried to visualize the Christ-like compassion and pity which the victorious Germans would have bestowed on the new million Wiesenthals now in their power. And reflecting on these things, I would have silently left the deathbed, having made quite certain there was now one Nazi less in the world. Hans Habe. On reading The Sunflower, I was greatly excited, as everybody who reads your story must be. However, you have not asked me for literary criticism, but for my views on the problems of forgiveness. The two unspoken questions in your story interest me specially. Whom ought we to forgive? When ought we to forgive? I imagine that you did forgive the man whom you call Carl S. But that is, I fear, too simple an answer. We are not an appeal court from God. He revises our judgments. We do not revise his. God's punishment struck the SS man, bypassing all human courts. He whom men punish can still be acquitted by God. He whom men acquit, God still may punish. But he whom God has punished, we cannot acquit, nor can we increase the divine punishment, least of all through hatred. He who has been punished is removed from our jurisdiction. Even the words requiescat in pace are a mere suggestion. We can hope that a person may rest in peace. We cannot ensure it. Immediately, there arises the question, ought we, can we, forgive others, murderers, who are still alive? Here, too, we must be more precise. Whom do you understand by we? If you mean the Jews, mothers and fathers, relatives and friends of the martyred and slaughtered people, then there is a considerable shift of meaning. Murder is neither forgivable nor unforgivable. Morals are not restricted to the victims. I have always doubted the role of so-called counsel who appear on behalf of private individuals in murder cases. To judge crimes against humanity is the affair of humanity. Victor Gollancz, the English publisher who immediately after the war wrote the word forgiveness on the Jewish flag, was for me just as dubious as are the Jews who take the sword of revenge from the hand of humanity. By we, I mean humanity, not the Jews alone. Is murder unforgivable? Yes, without question. Can one forgive the murderer? That is a question that is closely tied up in the complex of punishment. A desire to punish the murderer is the commandment of justice. To forgive the murderer after he has suffered punishment is the commandment of love. You write that Carl was not born a murderer and did not want to die a murderer. What has that to do with the problem of forgiveness? It is not relevant, and in no sense an excuse. Practically nobody is born a murderer. Those who are born murderers are the pathological exceptions. Their deeds, as a matter of fact, are more pardonable than those who are born healthy. The death of Christ on the cross is the symbol of a free human decision. He who decides to commit a murder is laden with a greater guilt than he who is driven to become a criminal by abnormal environment. Anyhow, there is hardly anybody who wanted to die a murderer. Even atheists are afraid of the hereafter. So, we cannot forgive murderers, so long as the murder is not atoned for, either by us as jurymen or by the supreme judge. Every society, I repeat, rests upon certain moral principles, at the head of which stands atonement for capital crimes. And this brings me to your next unspoken question. Can there be any extenuating circumstances for murder? It stands to reason there must be extenuating circumstances, otherwise every murder trial would be pointless. So we must examine them. In several passages, particularly in your conversation with the SS man's mother, you describe Carl's path to murder. That is the natural but complicated thing to do. One must not confuse the question of forgiveness with the question of punishment. If Carl were being tried by an earthly court, there would be such extenuating circumstances in his favor as youth, environment, the times, the general atmosphere, and war conditions. Nevertheless, in this case, we are operating in two different dimensions. Forgiveness is a spiritual matter. Punishment is a legal matter. The verdict of the court is influenced by extenuating circumstances. Such circumstances induce a milder judgment, but in no way mean that we are forgiving the murderer. The free will given to a man does not merely grant him the choice between committing a murderous deed or refraining from it. It is also a part of man's free will whether he allows justice to take its course or whether he dispenses with it. An amnesty granted to an unpunished murderer is a form of complicity in the crime. It does not foster forgiveness. It precludes it. Again, who should be the object of our forgiveness or our revenge? You are a man of high principle, and although you relate the story of the SS man and his victims, the proceedings which initially were directed against the murderer end with the Nazi system as the prisoner at the bar. Here, our paths diverge. For the regime we are discussing, there is no problem of forgiveness. The crimes of the regime were unforgivable. The regime has been tried and destroyed. Meanwhile, we are not faced with Mephistopheles, but with Faust. Corruption, though a force of permanent duration, cannot exist without collaboration from the corrupted. The corrupted, in a word, are not victims of the corruptors, but collaborators. With the words, "terrible vision," Faust turns away, but the ghost rightly defends himself. "You invited me cordially. You have long dabbled in my domain. You have passionately striven to see me, to hear my voice, to gaze on my countenance." The firm is Faust and Company, or, if you prefer it, Mephistopheles and Company, partners just like Hitler and Karl S. The proof lies in the counterproof. The devilish Nazi regime did not corrupt everybody, and of those whom it corrupted, most stopped at murder. I cannot accept the excuse that the system relieves the individual of responsibility. Walt Whitman says, "To the states, or to any individual state, or to any city among the states, offer strong resistance and little obedience." Resistance to evil is not heroism, but a duty. Anyone who thinks that he can get rid of evil in itself in the world is a victim of megalomania, and who knows whether megalomania in itself does not contain the germs of evil. The important thing is to strengthen the resistance to evil. Here, in my view, lies the true problem of forgiveness, and here perhaps we approach the answer as to whom we ought to forgive and when. Mankind will stay as it is, in itself a terrible prospect, if the principles of love and justice remain obstinately separated instead of complementing each other. Looking on the question from this angle, you will find that in the history of man since the beginning of creation, love and justice have opposed each other. At one period, justice was the human ideal, at another, love. The divine idea of justice in love, love in justice, mankind has magnanimously left to the Creator. Forgiveness is the imitation of God. Punishment, too, is an imitation of God. God punishes and forgives, in that order. But God never hates. That is the moral value worth striving for, but perhaps unattainable. You write at the end of The Sunflower, "I know that many will understand me and approve of my attitude to the dying SS man, but I know also that just as many will condemn me because I refused to ease the last hours of a repentant murderer." I belong to neither class of reader. It seems to me immaterial whether you forgave the SS murderer or not, for Providence relieved him of life and punishment, and your conscience from the burden of decision. But at least you did not hate the dying murderer, and that is a beginning. To forgive without justice is a self-satisfying weakness. Justice without love is a simulation of strength. One of the worst crimes of the Nazi regime was that it made it so hard for us to forgive. It led us into the labyrinth of our souls. We must find a way out of the labyrinth, not for the murderer's sake, but for our own. Neither love alone, expressed in forgiveness, nor justice alone, exacting punishment, will lead us out of the maze. A demand for both atonement and forgiveness is not self-contradictory. When a man has willfully extinguished the life of another, atonement is the prerequisite for forgiveness. Exercised with love and justice, atonement and forgiveness serve the same end: life without hatred. That is our goal. I see no other.
Yossi Klein Halevi. Wiesenthal's encounter with the dying Karl occurs in a dimension beyond our understanding and judgment. Presuming the right to judge Wiesenthal, the camp inmate, reveals a lack of humility. It risks repeating the mistake of those who didn't experience the Holocaust, but who readily condemned its survivors, for not violently resisting, for supposedly collaborating, for remaining alive. The very fact that Wiesenthal and his fellow prisoners debated the question of forgiving Karl is more than we have the right to expect of them. But we are permitted to judge Wiesenthal, the post-war survivor. By deciding to rejoin our world, rather than enter a bitter seclusion, he and other survivors assumed the burden of moral normalcy. From 1945 onward, they would be measured by the same standards as the rest of us. Their wartime suffering couldn't serve as refuge from scrutiny of their post-war lives. In responding to Wiesenthal's story, then, I begin where I have the right to begin, with his encounter with Karl's mother in 1946. Here, there is no moral ambiguity. Rather than tell her the truth about Karl, Wiesenthal allows this woman who has lost everything to at least retain a mother's pride in her son. He rejects his opportunity for vicarious vengeance against the innocent. Whatever happened there cannot justify cruelty here. Refusal to forgive belongs to that time and place, not ours. That simple message took me a long time to learn. Though born after the war, I was one of those Jews who tried to isolate Germany in a cordon of untouchability. I refused to visit Germany or buy German products. When I'd meet Germans my age, I related to them with blatant distaste, delighting in their discomfort. I wanted the Germans, all Germans who identified with that poisoned culture, to be exiled from humanity. Finally, I traveled to Germany in November 1989 as a journalist. The Berlin Wall had just been breached. In the frozen evenings, I joined the dense crowds moving in slow motion along the Kadam, West Berlin's main avenue, and was reminded, to my dismay, of Jerusalem,
in the weeks after the Six-Day War, the same dazed joy, the same incredulous sense of crossing inviolate borders. To exclude myself from the German celebration, I felt, was to deny myself an essential human experience, exiling myself from humanity. During that same trip, I visited a Protestant youth club in West Berlin, Meerbaum House, named for a German Jew killed in the Holocaust. A poster on a wall announced a trip to Poland to help clean the sites of former death camps. Other posters supported various liberal and fringe radical causes, from anti-apartheid rallies to Amnesty International to the Sandinistas. One felt that the dead Jew Meerbaum was the dominant presence of this place, that the young people here were offering their notion of altruistic politics to his memory. I asked those teenagers whether they felt any pride in being German. They laughed. Did they feel excitement when the wall fell? Blank stares. I thought of the enthusiasm with which Israelis their age react to a national triumph, the rescue of an endangered diaspora community, a successful attack against a terrorist leader, and it seemed to me that, as a people, we had emerged from the Holocaust with our life force more intact than had the Germans. The young people of Meerbaum House appeared so intimidated by the Holocaust that they couldn't allow themselves to share their people's celebration. But instead of taking a grim pleasure in their shame, I felt the emptiness of revenge against the guiltless. And I found myself actually urging them not to allow the past to distort the present, not to allow Auschwitz to deny them a moment of well-earned self-respect. Certainly, I don't believe that Germans or Jews should obscure the memory of the past, but since that encounter in Berlin, I have become increasingly committed to German-Jewish reconciliation. Wiesenthal's humane gesture toward Karl's mother reinforces for me the sense that, just as we are commanded to remember all our Egypts, there are times when we must also transcend them. For Wiesenthal the survivor, behaving graciously toward the mother of an SS officer required moral courage. For the rest of us, treating a new generation with decency requires only moral common sense. Arthur Hertzberg. This personal history of the dying soldier made him more, and not less, guilty. This young man had not drifted into being a Nazi, for he was raised by a mother who was a pious Catholic and a father who never wavered in his opposition to Hitler and his followers. When he decided to join the Hitler Youth, his mother did not put up much of a struggle, but his father was vehemently opposed. The teenager would not listen, at 14, and he was even more defiant when he enlisted in the SS. But on his deathbed, he remembered that he had been taught better. He could not, as some convinced Nazis did, jump gladly into the grave, knowing that they had, at least, succeeded in destroying almost all of the Jews of Europe. He chose to do evil when he was sure that the murderers whom he chose to join would succeed. The Nazi regime did allow faint-hearted soldiers to ask for other assignments. Had he heeded that impulse, he could have avoided committing horrible crimes with his own hands. But he chose to slaughter innocent people. Even if he was not entirely sure that the racially inferior should be exterminated, he did know that murdering such non-people would elicit special benefits for him from a victorious Nazi regime. Simon Wiesenthal perhaps did not remember, at that tense moment beside the soldier's bed, the teaching in the Talmud that no one has the right to commit murder, even if he is sure that he himself will be killed for not complying with such an order. In the text of the Talmud, there is the explanation, "How do you know your blood is more precious?" The dying member of the SS should have risked losing his own life rather than becoming a racist murderer or a careerist killer. He had asked for a Jew, any Jew, to come to his bedside so that he could make his peace with his victims and with God. Wiesenthal said nothing, and he was right. The crimes in which this SS man had taken part are beyond forgiveness by man, and even by God, for God himself is among the accused.
When he proposed, according to the account in the book of Genesis, to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because they were sinful, Abraham protested, "Would God destroy the righteous together with the wicked?" In the story in Genesis, God agreed that if there were as many as 10 righteous people in these sinful cities, he would spare them, but Abraham could not find even this small number. But in this dialogue with Abraham, the judge of all the earth did agree that he too must act justly. He accepted the premise that he has no right to destroy the just. In our time, we must ask Abraham's question. Among the victims, there were many righteous and holy people, and more than 1 million children who had not known sin. On the evidence of the debate in Genesis, Abraham could not have forgiven God for willing or allowing such cruelty. God can perhaps be defended by the answer that he gave to Job, "The divine plan is beyond human understanding." I cannot swallow the further extension of this argument, that the Nazis were instruments devised by God to help him realize his unknowable design. Surely, it is not beyond his power to achieve whatever he wants in the world without the near total murder of a people. Can anyone dare forgive the Nazis and their helpers in the name of the hidden and silent God who stood by the Holocaust? No doubt, as the Catholic he had once been, the SS soldier thought that words of contrition would get him divine absolution. Perhaps, after Wiesenthal left, he confessed to a priest and was given the last rites and assured of divine forgiveness. But the God who had allowed the Holocaust did not, and does not, have the standing to forgive the monsters who had carried out the murders. On the other hand, when Simon Wiesenthal visited the dead soldier's mother in Stuttgart some months later, he was right not to deprive her of her illusions about her son. He did not visit his sins on her. Wiesenthal obeyed the biblical injunction that each of us dies for his own sins, and not even for those of our children or of our parents. He could not tell this mother the truth, for the truth would have destroyed her, even if she had continued to live on as a physical being. These reflections were not elicited from me only by contemplating the moving story that Wiesenthal has told. I was born in Lubaczów, Galicia, in 1921, and escaped the Holocaust because my family was in the United States by 1926. I cannot make peace with my own generation of Germans and their collaborators in the satellite countries because my contemporaries could have refused to join the Nazis, but the majority hailed Hitler to the day of his defeat and death. I remember my own relatives, a grandfather, many uncles and aunts and their children, and I cannot fathom the mentality of those who murdered them for being Jews. Those who say that they are sorry and ashamed, I can only leave to their own guilt. I am just as pained by the attempts to explain the Holocaust. These writings may sometimes be full of historical insights or even ingenious theology, but together they obscure and cover over a question that can never be answered. Why did man and God fail so horribly? Together with Simon Wiesenthal, who said nothing at the deathbed of the SS soldier, we can only be silent. Theodore M. Hesburgh. Who am I to advise a person of another religion who has suffered incredibly more than I have? I would not ordinarily presume to do so, but I was requested to do so, so I do. My whole instinct is to forgive. Perhaps that is because I am a Catholic priest. In a sense, I am in the forgiving business. I sit in a confessional for hours and forgive everyone who comes in, confesses, and is sorry. I think of God as the great forgiver of sinful humanity. The greatest story of Jesus is the prodigal son. Can we aspire to be as forgiving of each other as God is of us? Of course, the sin here is monumental. It is still finite, and God's mercy is infinite. If asked to forgive by anyone for anything, I would forgive because God would forgive. If I had suffered as so many had, it might be much more difficult, but I hope I would still be forgiving, not from my own small position, but as a surrogate for our almighty and all-forgiving God. Abraham Joshua Heschel. Over 50 years ago, the rabbi of Brisk, a scholar of extraordinary renown, revered also for his gentleness of character, entered a train in Warsaw to return to his hometown. The rabbi, a man of slight stature and of no distinction of appearance, found a seat in a compartment. There he was surrounded by traveling salesmen, who, as soon as the train began to move, started to play cards. As the game progressed, the excitement increased. The rabbi remained aloof and absorbed in meditation. Such aloofness was annoying to the rest of the people, and one of them suggested to the rabbi to join in the game. The rabbi answered that he never played cards. As time passed, the rabbi's aloofness became even more annoying, and one of those present said to him, "Either you join us or leave the compartment." Shortly thereafter, he took the rabbi by his collar and pushed him out of the compartment. For several hours, the rabbi had to stand on his feet until he reached his destination, the city of Brisk. Brisk was also the destination of the salesmen. The rabbi left the train, where he was immediately surrounded by admirers welcoming him and shaking his hands. "Who is this man?" asked the salesman. "You don't know him? The famous rabbi of Brisk." The salesman's heart sank. He had not realized who he had offended. He quickly went over to the rabbi to ask forgiveness. The rabbi declined to forgive him. In his hotel room, the salesman could find no peace. He went to the rabbi's house and was admitted to the rabbi's study. "Rabbi," he said, "I am not a rich man. I have, however, savings of 300 rubles. I will give them to you for charity, if you will forgive me." The rabbi's answer was brief: "No." The salesman's anxiety was unbearable. He went to the synagogue to seek solace. When he shared his anxiety with some people in the synagogue, they were deeply surprised. How could their rabbi, so gentle a person, be so unforgiving? Their advice was for him to speak to the rabbi's eldest son and to tell him of the surprising attitude taken by his father. When the rabbi's son heard the story, he could not understand his father's obstinacy. Seeing the anxiety of the man, he promised to discuss the matter with his father. It is not proper, according to Jewish law, for a son to criticize his father directly. So the son entered his father's study and began a general discussion of Jewish law and turned to the laws of forgiveness. When the principle was mentioned that a person who asks for forgiveness 3 times should be granted forgiveness, the son mentioned the name of the man who was in great anxiety. Thereupon the rabbi of Brisk answered, "I cannot forgive him. He did not know who I was. He offended a common man. Let the salesman go to ask him for forgiveness." No one can forgive crimes committed against other people. It is therefore preposterous to assume that anybody alive can extend forgiveness for the suffering of any one of the 6 million people who perished. According to Jewish tradition, even God himself can only forgive sins committed against himself, not against man.
Susanna Heschel, I would have done exactly as Simon Wiesenthal did. Since the war, Wiesenthal's questions have taken on even more practical significance than they did for him in the camp that one day. Can we forgive the Nazis for their crimes? Can we forgive the German people? In Judaism, where forgiveness requires both atonement and restitution, there are 2 sins that can never be forgiven: murder and destroying someone's reputation. In these 2 situations, atonement is possible, but not forgiveness. A murdered person, after all, cannot forgive the murderer, and a good reputation can never be restored. The Holocaust involved both of these sins: murder and the defamation of the Jewish people through anti-Semitic propaganda. No matter how much atonement is expressed for these crimes, no restitution is possible, and no forgiveness can follow. But haven't the Germans repented, you might ask? What about the millions of dollars of reparations that have been given to individuals and to the State of Israel? Unlike South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Germany never established a public forum at which crimes against the Jews were openly confessed. On the contrary, denazification was imposed by the Allies on Germans, who by and large concealed or minimized their crimes. Many of those who created the Third Reich remained in positions of power after the war simply by denying their Nazi involvement, and their denials were accepted by a community that conspired with them to cover up and condone rather than repent. Even as Chancellor Konrad Adenauer publicly declared Germany's readiness to pay reparations, his Secretary of State was Hans Globke, the author of the emergency legislation that gave Hitler unlimited dictatorial powers and of the Nuremberg Laws that disenfranchised the German Jews. But because Globke was never a member of the Nazi Party, he was free to serve in the government, even one led by the impeccably anti-Nazi Adenauer. And the Nazis' destruction of European Jewry was not their only crime against humanity, or even against Germany itself. Historians have shown us that Nazi Germany was not simply an iron cage in which German citizens were forced to abide by Hitler's orders on pain of death, but was instead a cooperative society, with its citizens often eager participants in its crimes. Gertz Ali has revealed that some Aryan German families handed over their elderly grandparents or unruly children to be put to death in the euthanasia program. The outcome was both murder and a kind of national suicide, soiling Germany, perhaps forever. How could this ever be atoned for? My father, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, wrote that, "The blood of the innocent cries forever. Should that blood cease to cry, humanity would cease to be." Perhaps the issue is not forgiveness, but rather how the victims and their descendants can live without bitterness or vengeance, without losing their own humanity, when they hear the cry of the blood of their families. Rather than asking for forgiveness, the descendants of the Nazis should continue to hear the cries of Jewish blood and thereby preserve their own humanity. Jose Hobday. The question, "What would I have done?" seems to imply that my response might be a judgment on Mr. Wiesenthal's action. I make no such judgment. Altruism, mental gymnastics, conundrums, theologizing, and debates could swirl around this question. To me, these are not integral. For some, forgiveness is weakness and may actually be a condoning of the evil done. I do not agree. In the air is also the question, does Karl even have the right to ask forgiveness? That is beside the point, because he does ask. Mr. Wiesenthal tells us that he stays with the dying man, listens to his story, but does not want to give comfort to him. Mr. Wiesenthal leaves in silence, a silence that will have a different meaning for each man. I am of Native American descent, Seneca, Iroquois, and Seminole, and have felt discrimination all my life on this land. I have listened to the stories and read of the atrocities, executions, starvation, and genocide committed against my people. History gives us many accounts of these afflictions. Native people have been wiped out by government gifts of smallpox blankets. We have had dogs set upon us and have been shot down for sport, many more than 6 million of us. This, too, has been going on for centuries, while the invaders / conquerors have stood by and watched. Many others around the world have suffered terrible indignities as well. But the words of my Seneca mother to me when I was badly wronged and wanted revenge and retaliation stay with me. Do not be so ignorant and stupid and inhuman as they are. Go to an elder and ask for the medicine that will turn your heart from bitterness to sweetness. You must learn the wisdom of how to let go of poison. Forgetting and forgiveness may seem to be two different things, but I believe they are of a piece. Every time you remember a wrong, you are asked to forgive it. From my experience, wrongs will return to the mind for years and years and years. Each recall asks for forgiveness, and you stay in the power of that act until you let go. Compassion is all-embracing, extending to all creation, to plants and to animals, including the two-legged variety. Forgiveness is of the heart. I would have forgiven, as much for my own peace as for Carl's. Mr. Wiesenthal has gained the sure knowledge that he should follow the path of doing good and seeking justice. My hope is that he finds peace and harmony in his heart, and if the memory is still a burden to him, that it be wiped away. No one, no memory, should have the power to hold us down, to deny us peace. Forgiving is the real power. I offer him the sturdy sunflower of our great West. It is small enough to dance. Ho!
Christopher Hollis. The Sunflower, whether wholly autobiographical or in parts fictional, is an intensely moving and vivid book. Were it my task to write a literary criticism of it, I should be loud in its praise. But the request that has been made of me is to give an opinion on one definite point. Did the author do right in refusing a word of compassion to the dying SS man who had made to him the confession of the atrocious murder of a Jewish child? The author does not admit of any repentance for his refusal, but his two Jewish friends, now dead, thought that he would have done very wrong to have admitted such compassion. Only the Polish seminarist thought otherwise, and he has vanished from the author's life, so that he is no longer able to keep in touch with the developments of his thought. But it is clear from the author's visit to the SS man's mother that his mind is not at ease. It is indeed not clear what purpose that visit had, or what purpose he could have supposed that it would have had, since he was not willing to tell the mother the truth about her son, but the fact that he made it is proof of a disturbed, uncertain, and restless mind. I am asked what, absolutely, he ought to have done under these circumstances. Let me first make it clear that that is quite a different question from the question, what would I have done? To that second question I can make no answer. I claim no capacity to resist temptation above the average, and what fortitude I would have been able to show in face of horrors so incomparably greater than any I have ever been called on to face, I cannot say. We can all say that men ought to be martyrs if challenged on their faith. We can none of us say whether in the day of trial we ourselves would have the hardihood to be martyrs. But on the absolute challenge, what the author should have done, I have no doubt that he should have said a word of compassion. The theology of the matter is surely clear, and, as the Polish seminarist truly says in this book, there is no difference on it between Christians and Jews. Differences are here irrelevant. The law of God is the law of love. We are created in order to love one another, and, when the law of love is broken, God's nature is frustrated. Such bonds, when broken, should be reforged as soon as possible. We are under obligation to forgive our neighbor, even though he has offended against us 70 times 7. On the other hand, we are all born in original sin. Jewish orthodoxy, I understand, does not admit that exact phrase, but the language in which they repudiate it shows very effectively that they do in fact believe in it as much as any Christians. Indeed, one could not well do otherwise. For original sin, unlike the other Christian doctrines, is a definite necessity of thought. Men are born in sin, and when God has been defied by actual sin, there cannot be forgiveness unless there is repentance. We are indeed told to be reluctant to condemn others. Judge not, that ye be not judged. It is our duty to reflect how small is our understanding, and that, if we knew all of a story, we should often see how much more there was to be said for another's action, how much more, it may be, of the blame really is ours than appeared at first sight. But these considerations, so often just, are here irrelevant. Here, the SS man had committed an appalling crime. It was perhaps relevant for him to recount the impulses that had caused him to join the SS, the appalling corruption of Nazi propaganda to which he had been subjected, the military discipline of which he was the slave at the time of the act, but these are explanations. They are not excuses. The SS man does not pretend that they are excuses. He does not attempt to excuse himself. He was guilty of an appalling crime, and he was frankly confessing his crime. Nor has the author any doubt of the sincerity of his repentance. Therefore, however difficult it was, there is surely no doubt that a word of compassion, indicative of his recognition of that sincerity, should have been said. It is, of course, true that penitence involves a willingness to make restitution to the person wronged, and, had the circumstances been other, it would have been reasonable to have demanded of the SS man that, even if he could not bring back to life the little child whom he had killed, or discover any of his immediate relatives, yet he should in some notable way have attempted some service to the Jews which would have given evidence of the sincerity of his repentance. Whether he could or would have satisfied such a challenge had he lived and been restored to health, who shall say? Since he was to die in a few hours, the question is meaningless. Even if the author had doubted, one should give the benefit of the doubt. 'Tis God shall repay. I am safer so. Nor indeed is it easy to see, as indeed the author himself confesses, for what reason the SS man should have sent for and made this confession to a Jew unless he was sincerely ashamed of what he had done. Of course, I am stating what seems to me to be the absolute moral law. I am not suggesting that obedience to that law could under the circumstances possibly have been easy or passing any personal condemnation. But surely the absolute moral law was stated by Christ at the crucifixion when he prayed for the forgiveness of his own murderers. It is of course true that the persecution and murder of Jews was still going on, and that the author fully expected that he himself would be murdered before long. But that, I should have thought, in the moral order, made forgiveness easier rather than more difficult. The author's two Jewish friends, Arthur and Josek, argued with him that maybe he had a right to forgive injuries against himself, but that he had no right to forgive injuries against other people. But insofar as this act was not merely a personal act of one SS man against one Jewish child, but an incident in a general campaign of genocide, the author was as much a victim, or likely to be soon a victim, of that campaign as was the child, and, being a sufferer, had therefore the right to forgive. His forgiveness could not in the nature of things be the casual, idle word of someone who pardoned without caring the perpetrator of a distant crime to which he was really indifferent. Nor, of course, has forgiveness anything to do with the refusal to punish. In this case, since the SS man was just about to die, the question of punishment did not arise. But had he survived, the fact that he had been spiritually forgiven would, of course, have been no reason why he should not have been subjected to the appropriate punishment. It is interesting to understand why the SS man wanted thus to confess to an unknown Jew. The SS man had been brought up as a Catholic, but he had abandoned his religion when he joined the Hitler Youth. There seems some suspicion that on his deathbed he had a certain return of faith, or at least a desire to return to his faith. If that was at all so, if he had come to think that there was at least a possibility of future life and a judgment awaiting him, then it would of course have been reasonable that he should have confessed to a priest, had one been available. If there were no priest, he could be confident that the verdicts of God would be just, and, if repentance was sincere, need be under no fear that God would not show mercy. Whichever way round, why was his state made any better, his mind at all relieved, by confessing to an unknown Jew? The Jew had no power to give him absolution. It is not easy to see, but it is a psychological fact, that sinners on their deathbed do often wish to relieve themselves by telling their story to someone, and under any normal circumstances, who would be so hard-hearted as to refuse to listen to such a story? The real issue is whether the Jew and Nazi were two of God's children sharing a common humanity, or whether they are two different sorts of being, irrevocably at war with one another. If the second interpretation was that accepted by the Jews, it was assuredly the Nazis who were responsible for it, and they could not complain if the Jews accepted it. Yet, for all that, whatever the temptation to think otherwise, it is surely the inevitable consequence of any monotheistic faith that all men, even the least naturally lovable, are the children of God, in Christian belief that they are those for whom their omnipotent Creator did not disdain to die, in Jewish belief that they are God's creatures. One can well understand how the Jews in their camps had come to tell one another in the bitter, sick joke which the author recounts to us that God was on leave. Yet it was precisely the rejection of this blasphemy that surely religious faith demanded the belief that somehow, however difficult it might be to see how, God is not mocked, and that, as with Job, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Man, what is this, and why art thou despairing? God shall forgive thee all but thy despair. According to an old medieval legend, the apostles assembled together in heaven to re-celebrate the Last Supper. There was one place vacant, until through the door Judas came in, and Christ rose and kissed him, and said, "We have waited for thee." Roger Kamenetz. Dear Simon Wiesenthal, I feel silence under the circumstances was the best response. As a captive marked for death, you did not have the full freedom to speak, either to forgive or to condemn, or both, as the situation required. For this person, even by the manner he was treating you in that hospital, needed to hear your criticism before the conversation could ever move to forgiveness. Yet how could you know how your words would be taken, or what their consequences would be to your survival? You were under duress. The best choice was to remain silent. That leads to my main objection to the situation. You were not addressed as a person. You were addressed, from his perspective, as Jew. Not as a Jew, a Jewish person, as an individual, with a life, a history, a heartbreak of your own, but merely as Jew. For his purposes, any Jew would do. That did not give you proper respect, and in your condition at that time, respect was also precious. I cannot encounter another person's humanity as a category, but only when I meet him or her as a particular individual. That was the insult hidden within his approach. Yes, he saw the suffering he had inflicted, and he felt the guilt, but he had not moved past the deeper sickness of his soul and of his time, and our time as well. He could not see you as a person, because he could only see you as Jew. You yourself saw him as a particular person, a human being. That is to your credit. If he had also reached the same point, then the conversation about forgiveness could begin. Cardinal Franz König, Archbishop of Vienna. Reading about your experiences moved me very deeply. Your story is shocking, and not only because of the horrors you had to witness as a concentration camp prisoner. I found just as shocking your account of your student days and previous life at the university. The recurring symbol of the sunflower in your narrative, on the one hand, shows literary brilliance. On the other hand, it begs for a psychological interpretation, which I would not attempt. As for the difficult question you finally addressed to the reader, whether you behaved correctly toward the dying young SS man who confessed to you his participation in a horrible murder of Jews and asked you for forgiveness by proxy, as it were, I do not want to get into the general questions it raises concerning justice, mercy, sin, etc. However, I would like to answer your personal question as follows. Even though an individual cannot forgive what was done to others, because he is not competent to do that, there is still a question of whether one may forgive. For Christians, the binding answer is in the Gospels. The question of whether there is a limit to forgiveness has been emphatically answered by Christ in the negative. The distinction between whether we can forgive and whether we may forgive still leaves unresolved the question of whether we should forgive. You did the dying man a great service by listening to him despite your internal reluctance, by showing him sympathy, by giving him an opportunity to confess his crimes and express his regret, which means you acknowledged his inner conversion. We have reasons to assume that the dying man still believed in God, and that, through his personal confession to you, he did what he could under those circumstances in the hope of finding God's mercy. Even though you went away without formally uttering a word of forgiveness, the dying man somehow felt accepted by you. Otherwise, he would not have bequeathed you his personal belongings. Considering your situation at the time and recalling what you went through, an explicit pardon would have surpassed our concept of the human. Nevertheless, you had an opportunity to put forward an act of almost superhuman goodness in the midst of a subhuman and bestial world of atrocities. The fact that you did not take advantage of this opportunity may be what still haunts you as a striving human being. Summing up, let me conclude my reply with the words of the psalm. If thou, O Lord, shouldest mark iniquities, O Lord, who shall stand? Psalm 130, verse 3. Thank you so much for your confidence in entrusting this manuscript to me. Harold S. Kushner. I am not sure there is such a thing as forgiving another person, though I know there is such a thing as being forgiven. To be forgiven is to feel the weight of the past lifted from our shoulders, to feel the stain of past wrongdoing washed away. To be forgiven is to feel free to step into the future unburdened by the precedent of who we have been and what we have done in previous times. My imagination, contaminated by computer imagery, sees the human soul as possessing a feedback mechanism. Every time we are called on to make a decision, we not only weigh the alternatives, we deal with the memories of how we have responded to similar situations in the past. A voice inside our head tells us, these are the choices, and this is the way you have chosen on other occasions. Thus, Maimonides and Eric Fromm see that every time the Pharaoh of the Exodus story says no to Moses, he makes it more likely that he will say no the next time, and harder for him to change course and say yes, because his feedback mechanism keeps telling him, you are a person who says no to such demands. If we feel that our past behavior was wrong, being forgiven means erasing that message, liberating ourselves from the idea that we are still who we used to be, and freeing ourselves to become a new person. To be forgiven is a miracle. It comes from God, and it comes when God chooses to grant it, not when we order it up. That is why, in the Amida, a Jew prays three times a day for the miracle of God's forgiveness. To say that God forgives is not a statement about God, about God's emotional state. God's forgiveness is something that happens inside us, not inside God, freeing us from the shame of the past so that we can be different people, choosing and acting differently in the future. That was the mistake of the Nazi soldier in the Sunflower. His plea for forgiveness was addressed to someone who lacked the power, let alone the right, to grant it. If he wanted to die feeling forgiven, he should have said to himself, "What I did was terribly wrong, and I am ashamed of myself for having done it. I reject that part of myself that could have done such a thing. I don't want to be a person who would do such a thing.